Can I just say how much I've been enjoying all this talk so far? And I thank all the speakers for the effort they've put in to prepare the talks and to give the talks. It's not easy. You should try it, actually. Everyone in this room should try it at least once. Can I also admire them all for the valiant effort they've put into explaining and making sense of this thing we call consciousness and this thing we call the heart problem. And I use the word valiant because despite the excellent arguments from, say, Mike and Jonathan to rubbish, to rebut Chalmers' arguments, I do think Chalmers has it right. I do personally believe that our conceptions of consciousness really don't fit into our conceptions of the physical world, which is why philosophers have spent, 70 years since Gilbert Ryle really made his case for physicalism. They've spent 70 years trying to make it work, and they still can't make it work. If that's not proof that it's at least difficult, it's at least the case that consciousness, as Charles said, doesn't fit easily into the physical world, and I don't know what is. And I think I have the easier job now today than any of the speakers, because I think all the other speakers who were trying to fit consciousness and explain consciousness in a typically physicalist way, I think we're doomed to failure. And I've actually got the easier job, as I said, because I come at this with an open mind to this thing called panpsychism, which I believe is where the answer lies. And I consider this idea that mind might exist within matter, that qualitative states might be applied to atoms and molecules. That's something that's quite realistic, something that's quite possible. So I'm going to propose a position today, which I don't think you'll have difficulty understanding, but you will have difficulty believing. Because it's a bit like the cow jumping over the moon. Yes, it sort of makes sense, but we kind of know that that's impossible. So our brains will immediately say, no, we reject that. That's out of the realm of possibility. It's nonsense. It's implausible. But I'm going to make the case, actually, no, it works. It actually damn works. And if we've spent 70 years trying to make every other position work and we've failed, and this actually does work, then hey, this is probably the answer. So, Chalmers said, you must either revise, he said, to find a place for consciousness within the natural order, we must either revise our conception of consciousness or revise our conception of nature. Now, we've tried revising the conception of consciousness primarily by saying it doesn't exist, because hey, we can't fit it into the physical world, so let's just ignore it and pretend it's not there. And, you know, that doesn't convince everybody. So the approach of panpsychism is to revise our conception of nature. So my objective today is to actually solve the problem of the hard problem of consciousness from this vantage point of open-mindedness that I have, that perhaps I'm suggesting that the rest of the population doesn't. So I have an advantage. That's why, for me, it's easier than most. That's what I'm saying. I'm not cleverer. I'm just more open-minded. So I'm going to solve the hard problem by making a case for panpsychism. And then by solving the combination problem of panpsychism, what I'm going to explain is the equivalent to the hard problem, but for panpsychists. And I'm going to be aided by the logic of this chap on the right, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, one of the greatest thinkers, albeit fictional thinkers of the late 19th century. And he said the following: when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be true. So let's start with a riddle. What do you get if you take one non-conscious material object and combine it with a second non-conscious material object? Anybody?
It depends how you combine them.
Okay, well, I would suggest it doesn't. I would suggest you get a third non-conscious material object. And I'll give you an example. Okay, bit of steel. I suggest that bit of steel. Despite being a panpsychist, we don't actually believe rocks and bits of steel are conscious, as I was explaining to someone this morning. nor tables, nor chairs. And that bit of kit there is not conscious. I also believe that that is not conscious. And when you sit the two together, that hammer is not conscious. Now, leave aside what we believe about zones being conscious or otherwise, my argument is that if the first is not conscious, and the second is not conscious, then necessarily, and it doesn't matter how you fit them together, whether you put a little joint there, whether you stick them together, necessarily, the end result is not conscious. Okay? So if we can go along with that, then I'd take that same hammer, and I'd add another non-conscious object to it, and get a bit of a weird-looking hammer. And I'd say that if the first is not conscious and the second is not conscious, then necessarily the third is not conscious. And if it works for three non-conscious objects, it will work for four, and it will work for five. And so by mathematical induction, we can say that for all integers n, any combination of n non-conscious material objects will itself be a non-conscious material object. Now, I believe that's a non-controversial statement. I mean, is there anyone that would actually say now, actually, that's not wrong? Right, okay. Wow! That was half the audience. Okay, put your hand up if you agree with that statement.
So
you
have to be strong.
Brilliant, that's half the audience as well. So
we have three hammers, but not any object in the whole universe necessarily.
Okay, but what I would say is that if you start off with any one object, no matter how complex it is, if you add another simple object, say, so let's just assume that second object is always a simple non-conscious material object, the combination will necessarily be non-conscious, as long as the first two are. And so we end up with that statement. So I'm going to continue, so I'll take questions at the end. I'll run out of time. They can be moving about, they can be flexible. They can be flexible, they might be jointed, and I'm making the case that what we know about material objects, that glass, that table, that bit of kit, this is true. Okay, I'll move on, because I'm putting that out as a premise which we can argue about later, but I think that's true. But hang on. A human being is a combination of n non-conscious material objects, where n is some finite integer. And we've just agreed that for all, at least I have, we've just got the top thing out. We've just agreed that for all integers n, any combination, blah, 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 will be a non-conscious material object. Which means a human being must be a non-conscious material object. And yet, I'm a human being, and I'm conscious. So we have a problem. And what I'm saying is that articulation that I've set up is, in essence, the hard problem of consciousness. That's what we're trying to solve. On the face of it, intuition, whatever you want to call it, logic, reasoning, tells us that we should not be conscious, and yet we are. And we don't know. We don't know why. So a riddle leads us to a problem, and the problem gives us a mystery. How do the combined material objects that make up a human being go from a state of being non-conscious to a state of being conscious? And I suggest there are three possible answers. Firstly, they don't. Human beings are not conscious. There's nothing to explain, you know. We can eliminate consciousness from the picture. We are not conscious. Okay? I struggle with that. I mean, it's one thing to say the theory of consciousness can eliminate these terms and replace them by these terms and so on. But to actually put a statement out there that says human beings are not conscious, I struggle with. At least initially. So I don't think. I wouldn't go along with one. Secondly, a miracle happens. A conscious state emerges out of nowhere. In a way that's unpredictable, inexplicable. It just comes out. And we've tried it very hard to explain how. We can't explain it. It just appears. And number three, they don't. They don't go from being non-conscious to being conscious, because that combined material object contained consciousness in the first place. Consciousness already exists within the matter that we're made from. And this is essentially the standard argument of panpsychists. Every panpsychist will put it in a different way, and this is my attempt to make it really, really concise. But that's essentially what they're saying. Consciousness is already there, so we don't need to explain how it's created. It just somehow is combined from the material components that go into the human body, and thus does appear or arise human consciousness. So I would argue, along with the panpsychists, that one is evident false, two is impossible, and therefore the answer must be three. Now, before I move on and develop number three and see what three looks like, I do just want to focus a little bit on option two there, because clearly a lot of people do believe that consciousness somehow emerges from matter. So let's have a look at the argument for that. Excuse me. You've got something like this. Not all properties of complex material objects can be predicted or explained with reference to physics. For example, the liquidity of water, the folding of organic molecules, cell division, the path of a hurricane, human behaviour. Such complex material objects exhibit novel, unpredictable properties which emerge spontaneously and inexplicably. Consciousness is simply one of those novel properties. It's the same sort of thing. And it's a very appealing argument. And it's a way of kind of saying, okay, we can't explain consciousness, but that's okay. There's loads of other things we can't explain, and consciousness is just one of those. It's a fact of nature. But that is a red herring, I'm afraid. You see, it's true that when we look at molecules, cells, hurricanes, or human beings, there is nothing in physics and chemistry that will allow us. Well, certainly nothing in physics that will allow us to predict or explain in full the behaviour of those entities, not even the water molecules. And that's why liquidity is often stated as an example of emergent property, because the specific properties of liquids, surface tension and all the rest, you wouldn't be able to predict those properties, the boiling point, etc., from just your knowledge of physics. There is behaviour that emerges that we cannot explain. It's certainly clear for organic molecules, with folding of protein molecules within the cell. If you look into molecular biology, there's lots of behaviour of complex protein molecules that nobody has an idea of why they do it, how they fold, and clearly when you get to human behaviour, there's all sorts of bizarre behaviour that none of us can really explain. Now, that is all true, but consciousness isn't just one of those properties, because we can describe all of those behaviours, however complex, however inexplicable, we can describe them using physical terms, the language of physics. We can't do that with consciousness. It is unique amongst those properties, I suggest, that there is something about consciousness we simply cannot express with physical terms. Which means, of all of those entities we talked about, human beings do stand out more than the rest, granted, as being fairly unique, because we have this thing we call consciousness. So let's just have a look at how we would go about describing a human being in physical terms. Because remember, if physicalism is true, we should be able to do this. If a human being is nothing but the physical matter described in full by physics, then we should be able to describe a human in full. So, as somebody said yesterday, we don't typically use physical language when talking about a human being. We use other language, like 6 foot tall, has 2 legs, and so on. But we can fairly easily translate that into physical terms. Equally, we can talk about the person's behaviour. They smile, they move their arms, say hello. Again, that dynamic movement we can explain in physical terms, because we have the terminology within physics to do that. It's when we come to these qualitative states, seeing red, hearing a sound. And it's not the doing of the hearing of the sound, it's the experiencing of the sound that we're talking about. So it's knowing what that colour of red actually looks like, if we're talking about Mary, or feeling the actual pain. Not just a computer registering that there's damage somewhere, but actually feeling it, and actually knowing the unpleasantness of that pain. That sensation we cannot express in physical language, because it's qualitative, and what physics presents us with is quantitative terms. All of those terms, including mass, charge, spin, can all be defined in quantitative ways according to equations and so on. So there's something that's missing, that appears to be missing from those physical terms, that he's preventing it from translating those statements about that human being in terms of their qualitative states. Now, I would argue, but hang on, physics is not complete. We know that. And physics also is an abstract. Yet science in general is about building abstract models. So we've no real reason to believe that the model that we have of the atom is the full description. I don't think any physicist says that. That's why they're searching for string theories and other fancy things. So I think there's room there somewhere to add a few more physical properties. But when we now say physical, we're going to allow for not just quantitative states, we're going to allow for qualitative states. Now, when a panpsychist makes this type of argument, what they will say, and understandably so, is that we're not saying that an atom or a particle can see the way we see. We're not saying they hear sounds. We're saying that they, because they're simple, they have a very sort of simple qualitative state. Possibly not even conscious of having it. But it's a sort of qualitative state that when combined with lots of other qualitative states across the brain, either as combining particles, combining atoms, or combining the qualitative states of cells, that somehow that produces what we know as human consciousness. And it's a very compelling argument. Certainly, put like this, you can see that it seems more possible. But admittedly, they do find it still quite difficult. So this is perhaps why panpsychism hasn't quite taken the world by storm yet, because they haven't quite managed this translation. Once they do, of course, that will change the picture. Now, panpsychism is not new. What time do I need to finish, by the way? What time did I start?
We've got to be in coffee at 11 o'clock. This type of question.
I'll better speed up then. Panpsychists have been around since ancient Greek times. Spinoza and Leibniz in the 17th and 18th century liked panpsychism. It had its heyday in the 19th century into the early 20th century with Whitehead and Russell. And then it went into decline, if you like. People thought it was a bit silly. Once physicalism took off in the 20th century with Gilbert Ryle. But once the physicalists found that they were really struggling to make it work, then panpsychism made a bit of a comeback. And since the 1980s, quite a number of eminent philosophers have put their name to it, including Mr. Chalmers at the bottom. Now, he didn't do this when he first introduced the hard problem. It's only some years later, it's about 2 years or 2 or 3 years ago, he's actually said he believes that, the most likely answer to the problem will come from panpsychism. But they will all admit they can't quite see how it works. It's a struggle. It kind of makes sense that it should come from panpsychism, but they can't quite figure it out. The reason they can't figure it out is because of this combination problem. Now, this again is an old problem. William James, in the late 19th century, talked about this. He said, take a sentence of a dozen words and take 12 men and tell to each one word, and then stand them in a row or jam them in a bunch, and let each think of his words as intently as he will. Nowhere will there be consciousness of the whole sentence. So, we could do this in the bar, actually. It's quite funny. It's quite fun to bang their heads together and see if it will work. But let me assure you, you don't actually get minds to combine. For some reason, there's something about qualitative states that mean that no matter how intently people think, and despite what Cannon was suggesting yesterday, that we could have some sort of maybe telepathy between brains, it really doesn't look, on the face of it, that a few people standing there thinking intently of a single word would actually somehow create consciousness of the whole sentence. And this is the one thing that panpsychists, for a good 30 years, have been struggling to explain. And there's all sorts of papers put forward by William Seeger, Philip Goff recently, to try and solve this one. And it's tricky. It is effectively the hard problem, but for panpsychism. So I thought it'd be interesting to put these two up against each other, just to see whether we can see any differences. So a physicalist would ask, how is it possible for cells, molecules, atoms or particles in the brain to combine to create the complex conscious states of a human being? When, for all integers n, all combinations of any non-conscious material objects will be non-conscious. That's probably what physicalists are asking. The panpsychist would ask, how is it possible for the cells, molecules, atoms and particles in the brain to combine to create complex conscious states of a human being when, for all integers n, any combination of n conscious material objects will itself be a non-conscious material object? And this statement here is my summary of that combination problem. It works very like the hammer and the stick and the hammerhead. You try and bang the heads together, put them into a object, you don't get a combination that creates this new thing called a combined conscious or qualitative state. So these two are actually very, very similar. There's only one word that's different in there. On the left is the word non-conscious, the assumption that particles of matter are non-conscious. The assumption on the right is that particles of matter are, in some sense, I've used the word conscious, they probably wouldn't use that, but in some sense they have, that those particles have a qualitative state. But there is a difference. There is a difference between these two problems, and this is where the solution will be found. This is the trick. On the left, there is no possible solution. Its armour is pretty solid. On the right, there is. Because if you look really, really closely, for n equals 1, that statement isn't actually true. When you combine one conscious material object, it creates a conscious material object. Now you may say, that's trivial, and that's kind of going out of the spirit of the problem. Truly, it's about combining things, it's not about just having one there. That's kind of missed the point, and that may be true. But it does identify that whereas the problem on the left, it has got solid armour that's preventing it from being solved. The problem on the right has a chink in that armour. And if we could just put our sword into that chink and push really hard, we just might crack this problem. Because it's not entirely obvious what that means, but I am going to try. I do realise I'm running out of time. So how do you interpret the solution? Well, this chap, Christoph Koch, gives us one clue. And without reading that, what he's saying is that of all the conscious processing that goes on in the brain, only a small proportion of that is related to consciousness. Quite what the rest is doing, I mean, it's processing information, but why the rest doesn't create consciousness, nobody knows. But consciousness seems to come from just a small number of cells at any one time. And that was quite a surprise, I think, when neuroscientists did their research into neural correlates of consciousness. And what I've seen since 2012 there is that proportion seems to be getting smaller and smaller. So whereas he was talking about a few percent, they're now talking about less than 1%, and the more they look into neural correlates of consciousness, the smaller that number becomes. So what is the number? If you're a physicalist, how many cells do you believe it takes to create consciousness? How many have to work together? If you're a panpsychist, how many qualitative states of individual cells need to be combined to create the human consciousness? What is that number? Nobody knows. Well, I'm suggesting that solution, n equals 1, is where the answer will be found. Then that answer is 1. That means, if it's not already clear, that your entire human consciousness exists within one single cell. Okay. Bit weird. I told you you wouldn't believe it. Let's look at that and let's see if I can't make that sound a little bit more reasonable. If a panpsychist takes the approach they take towards cells and understanding how the conscious states of cells combined, and you actually look at the human body as a whole, the panpsychist might say, and I've not heard them say it, but let's play the game. The panpsychist might say that, well, all the organs of the body possess a qualitative state. They possess, in a sense, a consciousness. So there's my liver, feels something, it lives the life of a liver, my pancreas the same, and all the muscles of my body the same. But the problem we have is understanding how the conscious state of all of these organs combine together to create the human consciousness. But that's silly, isn't it? The reason they don't ask the question is that we know it doesn't work like that. It's not all the different organs that combine to create human consciousness. We get our consciousness from our brain. But our brain doesn't create it for us and hand it over and say, well, there's my consciousness, there you go, human being. We kind of inherit it. It's the very same conscious state as the brain. So you could argue the human being doesn't have a consciousness at all. The brain is conscious. And what it thinks, and what it is experiencing as a brain, then becomes the de facto conscious state of the human being, simply because the brain is the organ that's in control, it's the dominant organ. So what it thinks, and what it, the brain, wishes to do, is what determines the behaviour of a human being. And now we're fairly comfortable with, aren't we? Nobody really debates whether it's the brain that really holds our consciousness. But why can't we then play the same logic for a cell? That there is one cell somewhere in that brain that is the dominant cell whose conscious states determine the activity of the brain, who takes in all the sensory information and experiences what you are currently seeing on the screen and the words that you're currently hearing, and it's all concentrated into a single cell, quite possibly more than one cell, by the way. There could be a dozen cells all working in harmony together, all having the experience that you are having right now, but each one holding what we might describe as a human conscious experience in itself. And of course, you know where this is going. We can keep on applying this same sort of thinking. So that there's a protein molecule, the dominant protein molecule, probably within the nucleus of the cell, that dictates the behaviour of the cell, blah, 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 and therefore the conscious state of the protein molecule becomes the de facto conscious state of the cell, which, if it happens to be the dominant cell within the brain, becomes the de facto conscious state of the brain, which of course is the dominant organ within the body, and therefore that protein molecule is experiencing everything that you're experiencing now. As is that atom, as is that particle. And if there are fundamental particles in the world, which all the scientists assure us there are, then this actually comes to a stop. And all the consciousness we're talking about resides within a single particle. Now, who's going to shout homunculus fallacy? The homunculus fallacy doesn't apply here. The reason it doesn't apply is because what you're trying to do is, the problem with the homunculus fallacy is that when you do this normally, when you do this sort of decomposition, if you like, normally, what you're seeking to do is explain consciousness in terms of things that are not themselves conscious. You try to explain how matter somehow, this non-conscious matter, creates this thing called consciousness. But there's no creation going on here, nor is there any combination. The consciousness is already there. God-given, if you want to use that phrase. It's sitting there in the particles. But one particle... And by the way, this applies to all particles. I'm not just saying that there's one special particle or a small number of particles in the brain that has this special thing called consciousness. No. It's all your particles are conscious. And if one particle is able to possess the conscious experience of a human being, then they're all capable. It doesn't mean they do. Majority of particles will experience the life of a particle. And then experience the world of the particle. But some of them will begin to experience the world and the life of an atom, because they take that dominant role within an atom. And some of those atoms then take a dominant role in the protein, and they start to think of themselves as protein, because the information they're getting is about the world of proteins. And when they act, their intention results in is actions in terms of protein molecules, and so on and so on. And so there is a clear, because of the structure of organisms, quite distinct from computers, so this is why I don't believe that computer, say, this computer has any experience, it's because it's not structured like this. Organisms are really clever. They enable the particle, who normally would experience life as a particle, to suddenly find itself through a number of steps of being promoted to the next level of finding itself as a human being. Seeing the world as a human being. So, how does this help us? Well, we're now saying that this vision, hearing, and feeling that we apply, these qualitative states we talked about that might apply to a particle of matter, they're not these simplistic, rudimentary proto-conscious states that most panpsychists talk about. In this version, they're full-blown consciousness, just like a human being, which makes that translation possible. So we can, if we accept that particles possess actual consciousness, the vast majority of them, nothing, you know, they don't see what we see, they see the world of particles. But if we accept that they have consciousness, then we can translate, we can describe a human being in fully possessed terms. And to round off then, I put that there as my statement of the hard problem. The reason it's a problem is because statements 1, 2 and 3 are contradictory. They don't fit together, and you can see why. So, with this new understanding of the world, I should be able to modify each, maybe one or more of those statements in order to make them fit together. So let's have a go at how that would work. Human beings are a combination of N non-conscious material objects. Well, clearly what we say now is that human beings are a combination of N conscious particles of matter. Now, the next sentence does look correct still, but what we want to do now is talk about conscious material objects rather than non-conscious ones. And we want to recognise that this n is not just any integer, it's part for integers n greater than 1. Ah, but hang on a minute. That still suggests that a human being must be a non-conscious material object, because we clearly are more, there's more than one conscious material object, according to this, that makes it a human being. So perhaps this doesn't work. Perhaps I've made a mistake somewhere. Or maybe a human being indeed is in fact a non-conscious material object by this thinking, but I am not a human being. I'm a conscious particle of matter that believes it's a human being. This is the Descartesian approach. I'm not my body. When I say I think, therefore I am, I is my experiences, my feelings, my consciousness, or whatever it is that's contained in those. So if you believe you have a soul, guess what? You do. But it's not an ethereal soul, it's a material soul, and it's a single particle of matter. As you sit there, you think you're human, you're not, you're a particle. Thank you very much. Thank you, Bob. I did miss the last slide. And he did the conclusion. It's bringing this chap back in. This view of the world and this solution to the hard problem may sound crazy and implausible, but being consistent with the modern science, I'm suggesting it's possible. Since we can eliminate all of the proposed solutions as impossible, then whatever remains, how hard it is to believe, must be true. Thank you.
Quick few questions. Stuart,
you could
go
around
to either. Either keep
your hands up so Stuart
can see
who he is. Who have we got? Thank you,
Tim.
Thank you. Okay,
how's
that sound?
That's perfect.
Good. Okay. You talked about physics being quantitative and experience being qualitative, and they're the two crucial needs.
Yep.
I'm thinking back to Anne's sponge cake and how, you know, flour and stuff turns into this lovely, moist sponge cake. Because the states of consciousness are manifested by the process, not the physics that makes the process. I think that we're missing something somewhere.
The states of consciousness are manifested by the process.
Yeah, so...
I'm not sure I followed that.
Yeah, so consciousness isn't a thing, it's a process. We've got the reason you can't get over the gap is because you're trying to explain it in terms of physics, but what's going on is a process manifested by the physics, and that's where the gap is.
But I would say that process, if it's a physical process, it can still be described in physical terms. And we have lots of physical processes that scientists have no problem describing it in physical terms. And physics is not more than the static, it is the dynamic as well.
And maybe we can. We just haven't got there yet.
But I would challenge your view that consciousness is a process. I think, why? I'm standing here, and I'm experiencing, I'm not moving. All right, the process is going on inside. Why do you think it's a process?
Because the brain is
I don't know. I'm not sure I can agree. I don't know what that statement even means. There are processes in our head. That's great. They process information. They get information up my arm. If I put my hand in the fire, it gets information up my arm and it goes into my brain and I feel pain. That process of it going up my arm is not my pain. It's where it leads to my pain, absolutely. It results in my pain. There is experience going on at the end of that causal chain. But I think I don't see the experience as the same as the process. In my view.
We've got lots of people on
these
questions, so we're not going to get through them all, but if we can try and keep them.
In attributing consciousness to a particle, are you actually stretching the meaning of the word beyond how we would normally wish to use it? Very coherent argument, but are you not stretching the meaning to accommodate your solution?
No, I'm stretching what we believe a particle is capable of. So rather than thinking of a particle as simple and therefore incapable of the complex experience of a human being, I'm saying that in some way, well, presumably it is still simple in some ways, but it is also capable. The nature of consciousness is such that we are capable and the particle is capable of experiencing exactly what you're experiencing now. It is my stretch. So there is a stretch, it's just
so there
in regard to the particle.
So there is an objective experience of a particle.
The particle is enjoying a life, just how you are now. In my opinion.
Sure.
Anybody else?
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah, I didn't. So the n equals one solution to me, I didn't quite understand how it would not necessitate reducing to a single particle somewhere in the universe.
Oh, in the universe. I tend to think of myself as I think of myself as being conscious, as having a conscious state. I think of Marianne there as being conscious, as having a conscious state. I personally don't see any need to wrap us all up into one big cosmic consciousness. I know a lot of panpsychists do talk about cosmic consciousness. I just find that a bit mystical and a bit weird. I'm actually a reductionist, because that's what that picture shows. I'm a Cartesian panpsychic reductive materialist, you know. It's all a bit of a combination, but it does seem to work. I'm not cosmic, though. I'm not mystical. I try to be down to earth in terms of scientific.
But I guess my question is, in terms of the logic, how does your use of the n equals one allow for multiple n's?
Allow for multiple n's. Sorry, I'm really not sure what an answer to that is. What I think the answer to your question is that this process stops when it gets to it. Oh, sorry, hang on. No, it doesn't. No, you're very good point, very good point. It doesn't stop. It gets to a human being, and then a human being forms a company of, or a society, let's say, Filsock. And then the dominant human being within Filsock, where is he? Peter? Come on. Peter's conscious states become the de facto, and I really stress this word, the de facto conscious states of Filsock. Because when we act as Filsock, you know, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, the person that takes the final word on matters, because he's been here the longest and we all respect him, is Peter Gibson. So Peter's conscious states are de facto the conscious states of Filsock. And it could go on, but does it stretch to the whole universe? Could you say that the ecosystem of the Earth is a conscious being?
Gaia?
Possibly. It could be conscious, but it could have qualitative states, but it could be asleep. Gaia could be asleep. Maybe we're waking it up at the minute, and it's just sort of roused and it's going to get very angry. But I mean, I don't know. It's a bit speculative. But it's a nice idea. Does it go bigger than that? Sort of to galaxies? Yeah, maybe it does. I don't know.
You know, is a very friendly entity, and they always oil together and fire together. So guilty one, that means one neuron is doing nothing.
No.
Together,
no, I'm not saying that one neuron sits there and does everything on their own. I actually think, just as Peter works very closely with the rest of the committee and interacts with everybody in Philsoc. Why are you laughing, Mike? There is a lot of cooperation. What I'm saying is that conscious state, what we think of as the conscious state of this being we call Philsoc, resides within Peter's head. For some people, there's a collective consciousness of, say, in this case, the society or in a company. Now, I mean, it's a nice idea, collective consciousness, but I don't see it as the creation of a new consciousness. I just think we just take a consciousness we already have, called it Peter, and say, right, Peter, you're now the consciousness of this society. And the same would apply to, say, the chairman of a company or, you know, the prime minister of a country, God help us. So there's nothing created, no consciousness is created, and cells do work together. And most of them are very friendly. I've met lots in my life.
Well, thank you very much.